This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 Joycast. In this Joycast, you'll hear a summary of the weekly program. Due to copyright restrictions, the music has been edited to make this Joycast possible. For more information about the music played during the show, please visit the blog at joy.org.au/The Fool and the Opera.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Fool and the Opera. I believe it's number 31, which is quite exciting, for no apparent reason whatsoever. Tonight's show, it's about backstage opera, absurd opera and fruity opera. The explanation, of course, will make all the revelation will make sense to you at some point throughout the show. Now, I've just come back from, just jumped off a plane, actually not off a plane, off a bus, because I ended up in Avalon, but let's not talk about that. I've just come back from Brisbane, and I do come bearing gifts as well. I've got an exclusive for you from Brisbane. This week, we had the opening of Dirty Apple in Brisbane, which is an amazing opera. It's a very exciting opera. It is a youth organized, run, and presented opera. So I'll give you a bit of an exclusive listen to some of the things that have been happening up in Brisbane. But I've also got, I'm very lucky to be joined by the director of Victorian Opera's very eagerly awaited Ariadne of Naxos. So James McCoy is in the studio with me as well. So we'll be talking with him about, I suppose, the whole process of directing and all the different facets of it. So because this is the show for opera beginners, and I myself being a beginner as well, you know, we're going to be taking you on the journey, and James hopefully will guide us through it very gently. Now, I've in my travels, I've been listening to some more of the lovely Paul Schwartz albums, and they're really amazing music in the way that he sort of synthesizes opera and it's not dance music, it's more electro music, and it's electronica music, and it's very interesting. And I've recently become very obsessed with Verdi's Pace Pace from La Forza del Destino as well. So I wanted to share it with you today because it's an incredibly wonderful piece of music, and the introduction to it, the strings when they play on the start, it's some of the most beautiful music that I've ever heard, and it just really stirs the soul. And I think that it's a really good way to start the program for you today as well, just to stir your soul up a bit. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. On The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. And at the moment, I'm joined by James McCackie, the director of Ariadne of Naxos, which is probably the most talked about opera in Victoria at the moment. Everyone is waiting for this opera to come, and it's going to be opening this Tuesday. So thank you so much for joining us in the studio, James.
It's a pleasure, Dan.
And I understand that the General just finished yesterday.
It did, yes. Yes, I woke up this morning and thought, it's all finished. And I said, no, I've got to go and talk to Dan this afternoon. It isn't finished. And anyway, of course, we've got to get through the opening night. But still, the General was good. We only had to stop it twice, which I think is probably pretty good.
Okay. Well, I mean, this is your first opera, isn't it?
It is indeed, yes.
But you've been doing directing for a long time.
For quite a long while, yes. So it was both intriguing and exciting to be asked to do this by Richard Gill, with his, you know, characteristic risk-taking.
So he's taking a risk on you, is that so?
Well, I reckon, but anyway, I hope he's not regretting it. But anyway, it's been terrific experience. Yes. Mm.
Tell me a little bit about the difference between directing theatre, say, and then directing opera.
Yeah. Well, look, first of all, I'd want to say we can overstate these things. I mean, from the very beginning of my theatre work, I was interested in the relationship between theatre, dance, and music. And indeed, the origins of Western theatre involved precisely that, the interplay between what we would call theatre, that's when people take on a part and speak about or enact a situation, and music and dance, Greek tragedy. And that was where my work began, and I only became interested in doing Greek tragedy because it offered this both challenge and opportunity to work with music and dance as well as theatre, and I really kind of felt that this mix was tremendously important. And it's not a really very radical statement to make when we think, of course, that even if we leave aside the great history of opera, that we arrive in the 20th century and beyond, and with tremendous importance of music theatre. To me, you know, there's always an interest in the intersection between music and theatre. You start off, at least I started off, when I was going to a fully sung form of theatre, which I guess is opera, thinking, oh my goodness me, this is going to be very different, and can I do it? And I suppose for about the first day, I was a bit nervous. But after that, it actually fell really into place for me. And I think that this was partly because I had some really nice singers to work with, who were kind of very responsive and, you know, wanted to create a meaningful, interesting, and of course musically beautiful and remarkable moment or series of moments. Mm. But I suppose when I think, you know, what is theatre directing? I think, to me, it is about, you know, looking for the moment when something remarkable happens in performance, when your eye is seized, your heart is engaged, you have a sense of excitement and uncertainty about what the person is doing. To take the most obvious example is to look at those extraordinary moments when Hamlet, you know, our great quintessential theatre character, you know, launches into a quality of performance that, you know, goes beyond or transcends the actual narrative necessity of the moment. Mm. And, you know, if you say, well, that's what you're trying to do, and you look for the moment when the human being becomes something beyond itself in performance, well, then how deeply different is that really when you're dealing with an opera singer? Because it is the human being, it is the human voice, that extraordinary instrument, but it is actually trying to suggest a meaning beyond itself. If we just sort of stick with that when we're working on opera, then, you know, I think a lot of things turn out not to be so difficult, and certainly not so different. It's, you know, we talk, I think, a lot when we're working in theatre about the imaginative engagement with what you're doing. And I believe that if the opera singer imaginatively engages with what he or she is singing, then there's a meaning, a presence, a sense of action, a sense of narrative, which is built into the music, supplied by the music, and you could say goes beyond the music.
So tell me about this process of making them create that moment, because in terms of when you're doing just acting, I suppose, one of the things that the director, I imagine, does is sort of brings out, as you're saying, the performance that they wouldn't expect of themselves to do. Yeah. Is it a little bit harder to sort of do that with an opera singer?
It is both harder and easier.
Right.
It is easier in the sense that there's a remarkableness built into the moment in that they are singing remarkable music and they are remarkably trained instruments. At one level, you're not actually, it's not as if nothing's going to happen, if you don't mind the double negative. I mean, something is going to happen at that moment. Always, for my taste, Dan, and this is my sensibility and my experience of going to the opera often before I had the chance of directing it, there is, of course, built in a danger to that the singer will say, well, that's enough. And sometimes, and that seems to me that, to me, that's the danger where opera doesn't quite work, where you just say, well, they're singing and they're in costume and they've got a set behind them.
Right.
To me, opera works, and as I've seen it often do with, you know, great directors, when that sure sense that something is happening there and the music is kind of complemented, is expressed physically and spiritually, if I may say so, in the imagination and the performance of the singer. So now you say, what's difficult? Well, they have to do this while singing. I was a bit sort of scared about this, you know, how much could I ask them to do? In fact, there really wasn't a problem. I mean, if you share a question with the singer, if you say, you know, what is the event that this is giving rise to, you know, then together you'll find a way, and it doesn't involve great contortions or difficulties or distortions, I think, of the text. Let me just give you a particular example. I mean, this opera is renowned, shall we say notorious, for having one of, I've heard it said, the most difficult coloratura soprano aria in the coloratura repertoire. Mm. To me, because so that's exciting, you know, you're going to get that in Act Two. but to me, it is not enough, or in fact, it's rather unfortunate if that is what I'm waiting for to see how the soprano does the coloratura, the famous hard one from Zerbinetta. And, you know, fortunately I had in Teresa Borg a singer with a very strong innate sense of performance and music as entertainment, as well as music as important. And so we worked together. Well, I worked with her because the ideas were largely hers. on, you know, what is the performance that underlies Zerbinetta's aria? If we have succeeded, and I do feel very happy with what happens there, you actually don't, as an audience, you're not sitting back just saying, well, how is she singing it? You're saying, what is happening? Mm. And then what is happening happens to be with wonderful music. And after our first run through, Teresa said, oh, goodness me, we seem to get to the end much more quickly than I thought, because we were doing it this way. You know, normally it feels interminable to do, you know, because of the anxiety, you know, will sure. I get the next cadenza, you know. If we take her mind off that, we're also taking the audience's mind. And to me, that's a sign for me when opera succeeds, when you almost are surprised by the music. You're not sitting back and judging how well they're doing it.
Mm. Could you tell us very quickly about that particular aria and what it is about, just for those who wouldn't be familiar?
Thank you. I should have said that. Well, you know, that the whole opera is it's based on many contradictions and polarities.
It's about backstage opera, isn't it?
Well, the creation of an opera. It starts off being about the creation of opera. Maybe that's something we can talk about in the course of our conversation. But just going to that particular aria, there is the opera is, in some ways, it's about the antithesis between two styles of performance, and those two styles of performance, which are the opera seria, the classic traditional opera, and then what is called opera buffa, or popular knockabout, popular music, popular entertainment. And the really fabulous thing about the opera is that it puts those two again, runs those two against each other, which is a wonderfully zany idea for a couple of guy. Well, I think that Strauss probably was fairly zany, but Hofmannsthal, the libretto, certainly was not. So it's kind of a tremendously interesting idea that they do. Now, but the underlying, the two styles of performance are two attitudes to love. And so you have Ariadne, who has been abandoned on the island of Naxos by her caddish lover, Theseus, whose life she saved in the labyrinth in Crete and then fled with him. And she is she, of course, is the one who's in opera seria, the Sirius opera. And she's just completely dedicated to the notion that now the one big love of her life has gone. There's nothing else. She is kind of engaged now to death, betrothed to death. She's fixated, you know, love as a constant fixation on one thing or one person. And then opposed to her is the leading lady in the popular side of thing. And she not only sings of, she embodies the side of us, the side of love, the aspect of love, which will fall in love with the next beautiful person, the opera who works in the door, and she does that. She's as inconstant, or I would say gloriously inconstant, as Ariadne is gloriously fixated. So the great the second half, which is the opera and is the dialogue between things, starts off with a major series of arias for aria, very beautiful arias for Ariadne stuck in a rock, reflecting on past, present, and future. Then in comes Zerbinetto, who is the coloratura and the leader of the frolicsome band, and they theoretically come to try and cheer Ariadne up, which of course they totally fail to do, but they pretty quickly get distracted into falling in love with each other. Then the boys disappear, her supporting gang, and she sings really a series of passages or arias. Don't think they're all technically called arias, which culminate in one which whose words are, "Each man came to me like a god, and when he kissed this part of me, you know, I was completely dissolved and became a new person." And then the next one came, and so it happens in three stages, and with each of those three stages, the voice rises higher and higher. It is in enormous fun. As well as being very exciting to hear sung.
Yeah, it sounds a bit naughty.
Now, it is quite naughty, yes.
You mentioned that there are two styles of performance, and I thought that it might be a very interesting way to talk about the particular piece of music you've brought along to play today as well.
Yes, well, that actually, it may seem a long way from Strauss. I decided not to bring anything from the opera, you know, because I'd rather just
force us to go.
I'd like you to go and hear it. That's right, yes. But, you know, there's a story that interests me a very great deal, with, you know, that I've always liked the Mozart piano sonatas. And quite often when I listen to them, I find it hard to hear them anew, you know what I mean, because one has become so accustomed to them. And I came across these archival tapes just recently remastered of Friedrich Gulder, who late in his life played the whole Mozart cycle. Now, Gulder had started off as a virtuoso pianist, and then he got sick of the whole music circuit,
right,
and the classical music grind, and he spent a great deal of his life actually kind of in semi-hippie thing with improvisers and, living in communities and still playing music, but playing improvisers and spending a lot of time on jazz. So he really chucked it all up for that. What we would call, I suppose, and what is one of the great strands of popular music in our society. And then late in his life, he comes back and plays to study Mozart again. And what I love about this track, among many that are there, that when you listen to him playing Mozart, you get the radicalism of a new feel, a man who's been jazz improviser. And Zerbinetto and her gang in Ariadne of Naxos are improvisers, revisiting, what is now for us a very safe, or maybe a very safe piece of classical music. And I think that through that counterpoint of style that you actually find again Mozart and his freshness and his radicalism.
Okay, well, we'll play that. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. Opera on Joy 94.9, and we just played a piece of music that brought together two styles of music, jazz and classical, by Paul Gulder. The album is the Gulder Mozart Tapes 2, and there's six sonatas, and that was track 6 from the album as well. Sonata in B flat major K570. Actually, I should put on a bit of a voice for that one. It was the other radio stations were K570. I'm joined in the studio at the moment by James McCackie, who is the director of Victorian Opera's Ariadne of Naxos as well, which is coming to town this Tuesday, which is very exciting. Everyone's very excited about it. Now, we've got a few other people who are excited about hearing the program, so thanks very much to Bruce for your SMS, and also to Grant, who mentioned that the song that we played at the very start, he's not sure about the uplifting part, but he thought it was beautiful, and it almost brought him to tears. Yes, Pace Pace is a beautiful particular aria from La Forza del Destino, and it's the strings at the start that just get me going. And if you listen to the overture, there's, I think it's three trumpet calls, or the brass sort of make this huge, you know, it's an alert almost, and the music is just sensational. James, have you heard, have you listened to La Forza del Destino?
Well, naturally, but not in the particular performance that you're talking about. yes.
It's and you were talking before about, you know, when we're talking about two different things being brought together, you're talking about the fact that in the particular opera, Ariadne of Naxos, there's the bringing together of the behind-the-scenes world.
That's the other aspect. I mean, we've talked about the two styles of performance in what we might call the second act, which is actually the opera. The opera as a whole, Ariadne, has a very interesting history, that it actually didn't start off as a simple opera. It started off as a combination of a play and an opera. It's in the they first conceived it and wrote it as the first half was a boiled-down version of a play by Molière called The Bourgeois Gentilhomme, the Bourgeois Gentleman, which is kind of takes a crass, rich, upward mobile person, the sort of person that Molière laughs at a lot, rightly or wrongly. and this Gentilhomme has this kind of great, he's running this great feast for his guests, and he's invited a bit of posh art at the end, and it's all kind of slightly snobbish on Molière's part, but he kind of suggests that then the last moment that the bourgeois Gentilhomme gets unnerved, and so he asks along a comic troupe too to sort of cheer everybody up. And then as he gets more and more drunk or confused, he actually then tells them not to go one after another, but all at the same time. So that's basically the story on which the opera is based. But so it was kind of very interesting that that those first performances with a theatre bit first of a Molière play, followed then by the opera combining these elements, must have indeed been extraordinary. What they found was that it was, while it worked sometimes, it was very difficult managerially to organise, because you actually had to have a group of theatre actors and to do the first part, and then obviously opera singers to do the second. So that was expensive, managerially difficult, and actually, the fact, as we all know, theatre and opera really require two different spaces, sorts of spaces, even though we're doing this one in a theatre space. Normally, certainly in Germany at that time, it was difficult. So although it was well received and had one or two good performances, they progressively decided not to. They decided we'd perhaps better now go back and compose the first part fully as a fully composed musical and sung thing. So therefore, when you come to the theatre, you actually have this kind of strange double experience, because the first part is, I mean, it's a wonderfully humorous idea. It's actually set backstage and all the singers are arriving, and there's kind of a chaotic feeling of nothing being quite ready. Also, of most of the singers not being shown in the best light. In fact, that's putting it politely. They are regular pains. They kind of embody again and again like the worst sort of performance, which happily we come across very, very rarely, really, but one may come across in professional theatre or opera. And so it's kind of I would say the first half of the opera is really based on a farce structure, because that's what Molière is based on. He's not fully farce, but he's based on farce structure. And with a kind of a very rapid fire and quite comedic intercutting between the two troops who are assembling and all the tension between them, and then, you know, the escalating jest of people being annoyed at being thrown in with a completely opposite kind of performer, and then eventually being told they've got to do it all at the same time. So you then move from that, and it's a terrifically and quite an emotionally moving transition, that even though you've seen the armpits of opera, you've seen the backstage, let's say, at its most seamy and worst in the first half, that actually all that falls away in the second half. And you are actually suddenly given a world of great beauty. And I find this very moving. It's like, you know, all of us in our partiality, which that despite that partiality, we may hope, if our work succeeds, to suggest something that is actually a great deal more or beyond us, beyond our limitations. And I think that's what the opera suggests, because artistically, dramatically is a bit of direction and design. It's a terrific challenge because the two halves are so different, and you have to suggest both the difference and what connects them. So I won't say how we've gone about that, but I had a wonderful set designer in Julie Renton, and I think the set's terrific, so that you actually see bits and pieces of that theatre world arriving in the first half, and you also have to feel the environment of this rich man's house. And then that is transformed into something that is connected but different in the second half. Very interesting challenge, and it certainly means the opera, the audience gets two very different sorts of experience.
It almost sounds like the first half is like reality opera, where you get to see it all come together.
I think that's a very good way of putting it, Dan. I think that's very good.
Big Brother the opera.
Yeah.
Is it anything like that, you know, putting it together? Or has it been that sort of, it almost sounds chaotic. And in terms of this production as well, Jacqueline Dark plays the composer. What has it been like to deal with two composers? Not one, but two composers.
Yes, what a good point. Well, it's part, I mean, I was very concerned about that part in the first half. The composer's only seen in the first half when she's trying to get it all up and getting traumatized by everything that's happening. And, you know, you've got this challenge that it is a woman playing a man's part, which is only there because Strauss preferred a woman's voice. There's no, I have to say, evident reason. And the other thing that's difficult about it is that, like everybody, to begin with, the composer is seen quite comically as the world besets her and she gets up on a high horse. But very beautifully, by the end, she transcends within that act limitations, and we finish with a wonderful ode to music that is very moving, and a momentary romantic connection between her and the showgirl, Zerbinetta. I thought that was going to be very much of a challenge and something I was quite out. But Jacqueline Dark is just smashing. She's a remarkable performer from Ballarat, Victorian country background. She's got that wonderfully earthed sense of performance. And she just does that part to joy. And honestly, it just made it so easy for me. You know, I thought this was going to be a huge problem. It was not a problem at all. I just watched Jackie and said, oh, just maybe a bit further left or right there. Jackie, you're doing fine. You know, just let it go.
That's one of the things that you kind of get. You always hear these tragic stories where the director says, do this. And then when the conductor comes in, you kind of, they just say, no, just stand there and just sing.
Yes.
Which I imagine wouldn't be what happens between you and Richard Gill.
No, Richard and I have had a very happy and I think very fruitful collaboration. We did have to. There are some acoustic challenges in the Playhouse. It's not designed to be an opera theatre. It is designed to be a theatre, notwithstanding what I said before. And so we actually did, at the last minute, have to re-block two scenes in the second half just to get to pull things into better spots. But, you know, that is only was only two things out of how many hundred decisions you made. And so it was no problem. I don't think that Richard would ever stomp. He wouldn't stomp all over what the theatre director's done. But you know, that's part of the fascination of opera. It's the interplay between the theatre and the music. There's going to be some compromises. That's fine. You know, as long as both are kept alive. If it doesn't work musically, it doesn't work, does it? And I would say if it doesn't work theatrically. It doesn't work, you know, just go to a concert version.
Well, unfortunately, we've got about 5 minutes left, I think. And one of the things that we wanted to talk about, of course, was when you were saying about, what the director does. Mm-hmm. I mean, what you have done is very interesting in terms of, the Theatre of the Absurd, for example.
Yes, well, the Theatre of the Absurd was, I'd started off working with many composers in Greek theatre, where you need to have, you know, music. And then as I moved into the interest of creating my own new work with all the exciting new Australian actors and writers there in the mid-70s, the absurd to me became a terrific vehicle for improving my craft, because my view of the absurd, I think it's terribly ill-named, that in the absurd, that actually the actors are all creating a world. They're not embodying a world. They're not enacting something outside. In the chairs, they are creating an imaginary audience for the chairs. In Waiting for Godot, they are creating this act of imagining Godot, who never kind of comes. And to me, that's, you know, that was my love of the absurd. It's the, it brings you the actor as creator, and as always in the absurd, the creation fails, but that doesn't matter. You've got to feel the creation. And wherever I work, whether it's with people in the community, with the Timorese group, or wherever, people that I've worked with, I always look for the actor as creator, creating the event. And so really, that's not then such a big leap to work to opera, move to opera, because that's what the singer's doing. And together, I hope that we've created an event that will bring the audience some pleasure.
I hope so too. And for those of the audience who are waiting for Ariadne of Naxos, it's not too long, and it actually will come on Tuesday. So thank you so much for joining me in the studio.
It was a great pleasure, Dan.
And I hope the show goes splendidly, which we all are expecting it to. Now, speaking of bringing two worlds together, I did head off to Brisbane this week to go off to see a brand new production, which does bring almost two different cultures together, which is the young and the old. It's almost like bringing the grandchildren and the grandparents together in this particular production. It's been worked on for the last 2 years, and Opera Queensland have brought together a team of young people, and it is amazing to have gone up there and to have sat with, I think it was probably about 10 of them. I just had a chat with some of them, and it was amazing to sit there and have these 14-year-olds to 23-year-olds express how much they love opera, which is extraordinary. So I want to play you a sample of what we'll be putting to air next week. It is, I dare say, well, because I haven't seen Ariadne of Naxos yet, I dare say the best opera I've seen this year. It is extraordinary. And if you're in Brisbane, I do hope you go see it, because it is just absolutely wonderful. Now I'm going to play you the sample of what's going to come up next week. Ask anyone what they think of when they think of high school, and you'll probably get the usual suspects. Failed exams, skipped classes, voices breaking, even mentions of the musical. But one of the things that is often neglected or readily forgotten is schoolyard bullying. Well, there's a show that opens in Brisbane this week that's put together by a group of young people that attempts to deal with this rather difficult topic. Okay, you say, that's been done before. It's not such a big deal. Well, the interesting thing is, this show is an opera.
Dirty Apple to me is, it's this amazing new modern work which talks about issues that are really relevant to today's time, in particular to the schools and high schools around Australia. It deals with cyberbullying and all sorts of different issues that arise from cyberbullying and internet and websites and high school kids of today.
There's the traditional things of opera, like love triangles and jealousy and everything, but it's all mixed in with rumours and texting and websites and cheating.
A whisper, a rumour, something's about to happen. A whisper, a rumour, something's about to happen. Have you heard the news?
Composed by 21-year-old Jonathan Henderson, Dirty Apple was developed by a team of 14 young people aged 13 to 18 over 2 years. And while written by a group of young people, the story that has emerged is not one that is exclusive to any particular age group, as it plays on universal themes of guilt, loyalty, and self-preservation.
My character starts off, you know, there's lots of references to me being the leader of the school, and it's not specifically that I'm the school captain, but just this guy that is so looked up to, but then the fall from grace just really just hits really hard, and he's so manipulative in what he wants to achieve.
You can't do this. How can you be so cruel? Think about what will happen to me, to you, to all of us, to Veronica. Think about what will happen. Our lives will be ruined.
Militsa Ilic, who at 23 happens to be one of the older cast members, actually puts it quite succinctly. She calls it Aida meets Summer Heights High and with a touch of Law and Order. Or as some others have called it, it's Gossip Girl, the opera. When a group of four high school students in their final year get together and create a fake profile for hated music teacher Mr. Newman on a social networking website, the prank goes a bit too far when they imply he's a pedophile. The school immediately launches into investigation, and while the profile seems false, Newman remains suspended from duties until the creators can be found and his name can truly be cleared. The ensuing witch hunt challenges the friendship of the previously tight-knit group and tests the goodwill of the entire school community.
The school's
Dirty Apple features a deliciously youthful vernacular loaded with references to modern Web 2.0 living. And also, true to its high school setting, there's the mandatory addition of teenage hormone-induced lust, love, and loss. Cue, of course, the nasty love triangles, cheating hearts, and I quote, skanky bitches.
Parents are out, I'm horny, come over, let's have sex.
The libretto is very contemporary indeed. You know, it's not crude and it's not too in your face, but it's truthful, and it's truthful to what kids are saying these days and text language and everything like that. It's always good to have on your resume is experienced in singing crude language. No.
Slutty Emma at hotmail.com.
Dirty Apple is a massive production that cannot be applauded enough for its daring content, bold production values, and just sheer and absolute confidence in young performers. It's able to creatively cross barriers and bring together the culture of young people and of opera, or if you're rather, grandchildren and grandparents, and provide something that is entertaining to both of them. The question really is, though, is would the performers take their grandparents?
Definitely I would. I think it's great for grandparents and to take their grandchildren, for example, and to watch it together. And I think it's good for them to see what goes on. I mean, sometimes grandparents are unaware of the things that kids go through in high schools because of the different times and different generations, and because we're so immersed in computers and cyber world today that I think that's a different world to them. So I think it's really good for them to actually come in and experience it in that sort of form, operatic form, and it's a really beautiful piece of music as well.
A whisper, a rumor, something's about to happen. A whisper, a rumor, something's about to happen.
Students, please.
You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9, and that is coming up next week. We're having a bit more of the Dirty Apple. We've caught up with the composer and two of the performers. Now, the voices you have heard would have been Milica Ilić, who is one of the developing artists at Opera Queensland, and Jordan Pollard as well. It's a world premiere, so they've both just created original roles, which is incredibly exciting for them as well. So best of luck to them. It opened yesterday, and there are only about 7 shows in total, and it's part of Queensland's Music Festival and also the Q150, the celebrations of Queensland's 150 years. So it's worth checking out. If you're in Queensland, go see it. If you're not in Queensland, just jump on a plane. It's highly recommended. It is the most amazing piece of music I've heard in a long time, and just so great to see young people involved in opera. So that's it. As Jonathan Henderson would say, I imagine, I'll catch you next week. Same Fledermaus time, same Fledermaus channel.
Thanks for listening to the Joycast of The Fool and the Opera from Joy 94.9. You can find more Joycasts and the program blog at joy.org.au/The Fool and the Opera. The Fool and the Opera is produced by Dan Vo and Jed Gilbert, thanks to the support of Joy sponsors and members. Please help support it by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.